5302, Dialogue Between the Real and Surreal. My name is Amanda Roper. I'm the point of sale and data manager down the road at Alfalfa's Market. And my interest in this topic lies in the intersection between the real and surreal, creating those moments or blips, if you will. And I have a couple of housekeeping notes before we get going. If you can please take a minute to silence your cell phones or turn them on airplane mode, it's greatly appreciated. And the panel format today is we're going to have 10 minutes for each panelist to do some opening remarks. And after that, there's going to be 10 to 15 minutes of time for them to respond and react, comment on what each other said. And then there's going to be 20 minutes of audience Q&A. And today we're not going to be using the app because there's not the best cell phone reception in this room. We have some great producers. Kate and Matt can pass out a note card to you and just wave them over, grab a note card, write your question legibly on there. And if you're a student, please indicate that you're a student, because students get priority for questions. And I think that's it. Instead of an introduction, I was talking with the panelists a little bit before, and we were playing with surrealist moments and name tag or goofy names that are a little bit surreal. And so Kate's surrealist name is General Snaps, previously known as Cuddle Snaps. And Lana creates surreal experiences for audiences through circus. And Michael, he's the lime green eggplant, masquerading as an academic. And Elliot thinks that surreal is when you look in the mirror and you see a stranger. And today we're gonna have Michael start us off.
Thank you. Yeah, to my knowledge, although it's my first year, this is the first time an eggplant has ever given a presentation. Conference, so I'm honored. Surrealism, I think, I want to start off with some definitions of surrealism because it isn't easy to define, and also I think it's a misunderstood term. I found out that it was actually created 100 years ago this year by Frenchman André Breton. It began as a literary movement, and Breton had several agendas. Firstly, to tap into then newly discovered unconscious mind. Freud had just told us all about that. A parallel reality or a surreality. And he also wanted to disrupt and question the prevailing hierarchy and logic of French early 20th century bourgeois society, of which he was very critical. It developed naturally from the Dada movement, which in itself was a reaction to the horrors of the First World War, which had just shattered Western Europe. So, okay. Then the painters came in, and it became a style rather than a way of being. And that style was defined by the juxtaposition of different realities so as to unsettle and disturb. So, for example, Salvador Dali's clocks look real apart from the fact that they're apparently made from a material that melts, which is strange and worrying. But surely that's the postmodern stroke post-structuralist condition. In 2018, the West is anxious, unsettled, and disturbed. So I think the dialogue between the surreal and the real is now pretty one-sided. Depending on how you define it, I could propose that surreality is the new reality, the new normal condition. If surreality is hard to define, reality is even harder to define. In 1981, over 35 years ago, another Frenchman, Jean Baudrillard, coined the term hyper-reality, acknowledging the multiple ways that reality is simulated and the difficulty we therefore have in defining what is real or authentic. For example, Santa Claus must surely be real, as without him, there's no Christmas. And in reality, he wears red. Or is that just an advert for Coca-Cola? So where now do we find reality? Where do we find reality? In the Mitsubishi Outlander car advert? In Fox News? In reality TV? The media is, by definition, mediated. Its priority is to tell us what it wants us to know rather than to convey reality. So where now do we find surreality? Well, pretty much everywhere in terms of juxtaposed realities. For example, in Athens, which I visited recently, I saw Acropolis fridge magnets used as paperweights in the ticket office for the actual Acropolis. In Reykjavik, last week, I went to the toilet in a small coffee shop and found myself in a themed Star Wars space complete with John Williams' overture. In the US, you have a quite homogenised society, but that doesn't make it any more real. Coke was never the real thing, it was just something they wanted us to buy. Casinos in abandoned Rocky Mountain towns that owe their existence to the gold rush are both surreal and ironic. So the juxtaposition of different realities that unsettles and disturbs us has now become, for most of us in the West at least, our everyday experience. This is the age of anxiety. It's so embedded in our daily lives, we no longer recognise it. For example, we do have Donald Trump in the White House. One of the principles of the Surrealist group was to mix high and low cultures as a means of representing our unconscious desires, however uncomfortable and palatable they may prove to be. President Trump. Surreal. Now, we would not recognise reality if it came up behind us, tapped us lightly on the shoulder and said, "Hi there, I'm reality." Why is surrealism everywhere? Okay, so in a neoliberal society, we are encouraging surrealism as a normal condition. I'll give you an example. Louis Vuitton handbags retail for $4,150. I googled it. Marx called this commodity fetishism, where the monetary value of an object bears no relation to its functional value. Louis Vuitton handbags sell for over $4,000, not because they're worth that, but because people will pay that for them. These are two juxtaposed realities, the exchange value and the functional value. So this surreal condition is what keeps the cash registers ringing. However, one last thing to add. Our surreal epoch makes for very good comedy. Comedy reveals the absurdities that are so embedded in our everyday lives, we no longer recognise them. For example, the confusion that the privileged Western liberal elite have over the words want and need. That's us, by the way. We cannot take politics seriously anymore. And whereas the arts take an increasingly shrinking moral high ground, stand-up comedy first makes us laugh, ridiculing authority and sometimes integrity, before we realise it's all horribly true. On the other hand, to finish with Masson again, have we rejected the values of bourgeois society? Not really. Do we regularly acknowledge our unconscious selves? Not really. To some extent, the surreal has challenged the real. However, the real is still alive and kicking, albeit in our private rather than public lives. I don't see much dialogue. Is that bad news? Not for Donald Trump. Not for neoliberalism, not for stand-up comedy.
Elliot, would you like to
come in? Oh, am I next? Okay. Well, that was fascinating. I actually, I guess I should have prepared more for this panel because I didn't know that much about the history of surrealism, so thank you. That was really a wonderful way to kick off. So I write science fiction novels for a living, and there's a lot of my job is trying to figure out how can I mix things that feel real with things that are unreal in a way that still is plausible. Right, that still allows the reader to engage with the material, to engage with the characters, to engage with the world that they're experiencing. And you know, I think that one of there are a few ways to look at surreality, at least from the literary angle. One is that if you interrogate yourself in your everyday experience, our day-to-day experiences are much weirder than we give them credit for. So we just heard some great examples like the fridge magnet, right, of external details that we can notice in the world that are just really strange, or certainly having Donald Trump in the White House is extremely strange. But that is also true internally. We sort of have this like idea that everyone is experiencing this shared objective reality, and yet most of our thoughts are often about sort of like social anxiety or maybe playing out an experiment where what, I mean, I remember when I was a kid driving in the back of a car, right? My mom was driving me, I think, home from school, and I just had these thoughts of like, what would happen if I opened the door and leapt out, right? We're going 70 miles an hour down the freeway. And like, in my mind, like, it became an incredibly disturbing, very gory, you know, episode, and it was pretty fascinating. And that's a thought I didn't share with my mom, although I'm sharing with you now. So, but we often don't give ourselves or others credit for that. But because those thoughts feel private and given whatever social norms we've established, those aren't things that you normally would tell your mom. It can sometimes feel like we're alone with those thoughts, right? Like that strange, that inherent strangeness in the human experience is actually something that's alienating. And I know that as a lover of surrealist art in many formats, one of the things that I get from it is that it shows me that I'm not alone, right? It shows me that internal experience of how freaking weird life is actually very, very powerful. You mentioned that one definition of surrealism sort of gets like that it pairs reality with this unreality in a way that makes things disturbing. Mm-hmm. And right before we started the panel, we were chatting about the television show Black Mirror. So I don't know how many of you have watched it. It's on Netflix, but it's very disturbing. It plays out these sort of like near future scenarios. The thing that I always try to get to, though, because I can only watch one episode a month, because otherwise it's a little too much. My books have been compared to those shows, and the funny thing is, when I look at them, I see them as being very different. Because when I finish watching Black Mirror, although I love it, I feel very disturbed about the world. But I think that the other really interesting component to surrealist art or surreal experience is that it can also ignite a sense of wonder, right? By seeing different universes paired next to each other, suddenly you can come back to your own with a fresh perspective, right? You can start to notice the strange things like the casinos in the mountains, right? Which it's very easy to acclimate to, right? In fact, like one of the scariest things about the current presidential administration in the U.S. is how now it feels normal, right, to like look, read the news like that. So I think that that's a really interesting thing that surrealism has to offer us, is that it can make us question things, it can certainly disturb us, but it can also help us see the world in a way that's more meaningful and sort of, yeah, ignite that sense of wonder, of inspiration. And I'll share one practical way, that I actually try to embed the experience of surreality into a novel as I am writing it. So if you guys like this panel, I would recommend you follow it up by reading a book called Gödel, Escher, Bach, which is a really fascinating philosophy book from the middle of the 20th century. And it is all about this concept of strange loops. So all of you guys have probably seen those Escher paintings where you have stairs that are infinitely recursive and the hands that like go like this forever. And they certainly have that emotional experience for me of like, whoa, this is fascinating and disturbing. I can't really look away, right? Like it's weird, right? And the book points out that thing, that strange loop, is actually true of many other kinds of art, not just Escher paintings. Bach's music, it follows the precise same principle. You can actually loop his music into each other forever and just keep going forever, right? And so this element of the work of art being a self-contained universe that is essentially a hall of mirrors just reflecting itself is really, really powerful because it sucks our attention in, right? And it makes us question how the universe is constructed. So when I am writing the rough draft of a new novel, I try to tease out where those strange loops might grow, right? So as a very practical example might be if the story starts in one place, right? And then, so like literally, let's say the story, don't tell my publisher, but you know, like there's a manuscript that's in editorial now where the first scene is set in a greenhouse, right? And this is a science fiction thriller, so there's a lot of stuff that's gonna happen. And you know, everything goes disastrously for the protagonist, but I really knew from the first moment when I started writing the novel, that the last scene was also going to take place in the same greenhouse, right? Even though, like, that doesn't really matter, for, like, right? Like, it's not that core to the plot of the story, but it creates this feeling for the audience. And then I realized, oh, wait, so this is sort of interesting. If you had a greenhouse, that probably means you love gardening, you love plants, right? And you would probably look at the world and look at your own problems and see plants as a metaphor for seeing the world. So I asked around. I asked some friends. I actually went on Facebook and Twitter, which I thought would have like no response. And I was like, hey, I'm writing this novel. Does anybody know more than me about gardening? And do you want to like share some of your perspectives on it? And like, overwhelming. Apparently a lot of people really like talking about gardening on social media, and so that was lovely for me. But what was really, really cool was not the details of, you know, what soil chemistry you need for a specific plant, but actually how people who love growing plants, how they build a relationship with the plants they grow, right? And suddenly that becomes a metaphor in the character's life. Right, so as she's going through her struggles, as she's literally like being gunned down in certain scenes later in the novel, that is how she interprets her struggles. That's how she gets through, you know, and to the next season, and you know, has more of a rebirth and transforms throughout the novel. That those plants suddenly become core to her experience. Right, the foggy reflection she sees in the walls of the greenhouse when she's exiting. That can suddenly be a really transformational moment where you are wondering who you really are, right? So there are all of these opportunities when you're actually creating a body of work, and I'd be really interested to hear, because I think we all work in very different formats, if this resonates at all. But I know that when working at novels, I'm always searching for that opportunity, and that ends up creating an experience for the reader at the end of the day where it has that strange recursiveness to it. It draws us in. It brings us into the surreal. And hopefully by doing so, gives us a glimpse of something that is true and that is real.
I think that that Elliot's right in that the work that all four of us do is all very different, but ultimately, in each of our mediums, we're attempting to kind of pull people out of their everyday state of mind, or maybe put them further into a deeper connection to their everyday state of mind, basically opening doors and trying to transform someone's experience, create an experience for people. I mostly do event production and festival management, and one of the real reasons I do that type of work is to create spaces where people can kind of step out of their everyday reality and find that liminal space or that space in between. And I think something that's super interesting is about a mediated experience versus immediate experience. We live in a completely mediated society where everything we're experiencing all the time is filtered and, you know, like, who is Santa and is he from Coca-Cola? Like, this is a really great example of how much media is influencing the way that we perceive reality. So one of the things that's been a really core sort of philosophy around the type of work that I've done is getting people into an immediate experience where... And one of those concepts is also known as the temporary autonomous zone, which are temporary spaces. They're kind of pockets in the space-time continuum where maybe a minute can feel like forever or the other way around. The easiest way, I think, to get to a surreal state of mind or maybe a very real state of mind is to go into the woods with your friends and dance all night and watch the sunrise, because by the time the sun comes up, you will see things differently. That's an immediate experience. That's like, you're not there. What filters are there? Okay, the music, that's a filter, that's a media, but you're really cutting the fat away, if you will. You're getting down to the core of what it is that we are all doing, just being human. And so I do really think that the mediated reality and the age of anxiety, these things are very connected. And to me, that state of mind, when maybe time doesn't necessarily feel, time becomes more viscous, is more real than how I feel sitting here right now, knowing that the clock is ticking and that I'm being recorded.
Terrifying.
It's terrifying, isn't it? Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's really inspiring to sit on a panel with people that really have such different backgrounds in the field of how we play with surrealism. I do circus, and I also looked up surrealism on Wikipedia, and I found the words unnerving, illogical, strange, and dreamlike. And I thought, okay, that's probably what circus tries to do as well. And I kind of liked what Elliot said. I liked your story when you were sitting in your mother's car and you were wondering this, what if I do this? And I kind of feel like that's what we constantly do in circus. We're asking, what if? What if we fly through the air and I do a double somersault and I land on this tiny little platform over here? What if? What if? So in this dialogue between the surreal, the what if, and the real, I was thinking back on how to become a circus performer. And I found a lot of very real things in there to become something that seems surreal later on. First of all, I see a lot of real work, physical, mental, and artistic work. Physical work, it's hours and hours and hours and days and days and days and months and months and months and years and years and years of training. Of getting up in the morning, your body is still aching from the training the day before. Your muscles are tired, you're tired, but you're getting up, you're getting into the gym, you have a coach there, you're doing the same training over and over again. Your muscles are tired, your hands are hurting. It's sweat, it's blood, it's so much physical work that you have to put in to achieve the what if I can one day hold this handstand. It's a lot of mental work too that goes into that. Getting up in the morning and really actually going to the gym. And I'm just thinking of like handstand training. Handstand training takes such a long time only to be able to actually stand on your two hands and not falling. It takes, I think, at least 2 years until you really feel like, I think I understand now how to stand on my two hands. And you have to deal with frustration, with failing. You try it over and over again. You have a coach that gives you the same comment every single day for months. Well, you just have to engage your core. You just have to align all of your muscles. All of your bones need to be in one position. Then you're like a stick, and then you can stand. Easy. Then you fall again. All you ask is like, why you fall? Well, because I don't really, well, if you put this, if you do this, so it's lots of frustration that goes into that. It's a lot of mental work to keep yourself going forward and repeating and repeating. There's artistic work as well. We're not all born and know how to be great artists, and I think it's a constant learning that goes on. But we have to try and we have to fail so many times. And we have to fail in front of others. We have to fail in front of our teachers. We have to fail in front of our peers. We have to deal with the feedback. We're putting so much work into what we want to present. We present it. And it's harsh. It's harsh to then hear that they didn't like it or they didn't feel it. And I was feeling so much, but no one in the audience was feeling it. And to go through this artistic work and to this artistic process of dealing with the feedback and working with the feedback and understanding what I can do better and how I can better reach an audience and all of this. So it's the real work that goes into this. And then there's real risks too. There's financial risks. Do I really want to become an artist? What does it mean for me, for my life? I will probably never have a stable job. I will probably work as a freelancer. I go from contract to contract. I have one contract, 2 months of shows, great. And then after, I have no idea what I'm doing next. Maybe I get a 1 or 2 year contract. I tour with a company. I'm touring all over the world. That's great. And after, I have no idea what I do when I retire. My retirement probably starts when I'm 30 or 35. There's a lot of social risk as well. I might be living a very, very different life from the life that my family is living. Even the friends that I went to high school with. Will I be isolated? I will be traveling a lot. I won't be in one place with the same people around me. I'll go to new places. I will work with new people. I have to find new friends, new family all of the time. And then there's physical risks. The risk of injuries, accidents, and even death. We've all gone through injuries and accidents. We all know friends that had accidents or injuries that you train for 6, 7, 8 years. You have a great career and then you have one accident and all of a sudden you have to quit. You have to change your life completely. So there's all of these real risks and these real work that goes into creating a surreal world for the audience. So I don't want to end on this like down because I'm wondering like why are we doing this still, right? And I think it's the sense of wonder that Elliot was talking about, this possibility to reach an audience and to show people that the impossible is possible. And I just thought if you are willing to take on a lot of the real work and if you're willing to take on a lot of the real risks, and if you're one of the few crazy people who would be willing to be doing that, I think that it's, if you have the opportunity, it's your responsibility to do it and to show that there's a sense of wonder somewhere out there. Thank you.
Now we have an opportunity for you guys to ask questions to each other and just talk amongst yourselves. Does anyone want to start?
I was just listening about circus and I was struck by the fact that surrealism as manifest in circus, which it certainly is I didn't use the word wonder, I would say seductive. It's very seductive. We're very seduced by surrealism. We're very attracted to things that seem illogical, like somebody being able to do the things you can do. And I think that's part of our DNA as humans, that we want to embrace the unknown. We want to know. I guess it's the same science fiction. That's why we like science fiction. We want to encounter that. We don't want to just encounter the real, because it's not very interesting. It's an observation. Mm.
So that made me think of one thing, which is like daydreams. Like daydreams are really interesting, and I find they're often like really great creative material to mine from. And I would actually I would suggest that as a takeaway from this session, you guys can all try this over the next few days. So you guys can confirm whether or not this pairs with like your creative process. Like I was thinking of your what if scenarios, mm-hmm. right? But like we often run these scenarios in our head. Right? And sometimes it might be like you're going in and you're like, oh my God, I've been doing this job for 15 years, I've gone to the office, I'm sort of bored. Like, I had all, you know, what if the CIA had recruited me in college, or something along those lines, right? We have these like weird thoughts all the time. And one of the things that I try to do, and that really ends up informing my fiction, is I try to take the daydream ridiculously seriously, right? So, because usually you'll have that thought, what if I was a spy, right? And really what you're doing is you're expressing your dissatisfaction with your boredom at work, right? And then I would, but like, don't stop there. Now, don't just like move on to the next easy thought of like, I'm checking Twitter, or I'm doing the dishes, or whatever. Take that further, right? Like, if you were a spy, like, what kind of suit would you wear, right? Like actually, what kind of suit would you wear? And like, do you think that that suit, you know, because often you see spy movies and spies are wearing suits. Do you think that the spies are really doing all their, like, physical chases in those suits? Because, I mean, if you've ever worn men's formal shoes, like, they've got terrible traction, right? Like, if you were really doing the kind of, like, street chases on the paved streets of Rome in those shoes, I mean, you'd be flying all over the place, right? So, and then, like, if you are a spy, I mean, you know, you're probably going to be moving around the world a lot. How does that impact your relationships, right? Oh, wow, like, I, you know, like, James Bond, all of his relationships end badly, right? And he's not even a particularly realistically portrayed spy. So, it, like, if you can take that daydream and just, like, take it, just beyond the pale of far, right, where you can really have these constructed, detailed, imaginary worlds in your mind. First of all, it's fun. It's a really interesting way to engage with that seductive surreal. But the thing that I often find is that once I've done that, suddenly I literally feel lighter. I feel lighter in my own life because I've taken whatever that kernel was, that emotional kernel inside me that might have been that I was bored at work or whatever, and I've externalized it. I've taken it, and I've taken it far enough outside of myself that suddenly I can, you know, look at it and sort of laugh at myself and take myself a little bit less seriously, and it feels like a burden is really lifted away from me. And so I think it's actually a really fun practice that can actually be really positive in terms of well-being and experience of the world. So give it a shot. And I'd love to hear what you think if it works.
I can say it feels like you're talking about a sort of therapeutic value of surrealism in the way that Freud talked about in releasing unconscious desires.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
I think it is a good exercise. To let your mind go a little bit. We are not encouraged to use our imagination. Like, we're encouraged to stay focused and to use every moment that you have in this very precise way. And it's actually very unhealthy for not just the creative process, but for any process. I think what this moment in the conversation is getting towards is allowing oneself to breathe through these potential scenarios or even ideas or think about color or smell or whatever. Just be experiencing things. And I believe that it's maybe statistical that daydreaming is actually a really great way to rest the mind and be able to go back into your whatever task you're doing and do it better. But another thing I was thinking about is how we are all working towards manifesting the impossible. So this is a part of what I think each of us are doing in our practices, like the science fiction writing and being able to dive into that reality and see something that maybe seems impossible, but you're bringing it to life. And the theater work that you do, Michael, really brings people directly into that. They become the theater in that moment. And I'm curious about your creative process in that, in the way that you engage audiences and.
I think you've just described it. It's about audience. It's about what Elian was talking about in releasing unconscious desires, so we can be part of something rather than separate from it. In the way that we are separate here, you know, what I'm interested in is breaking the physical space of the audience and the performer. So we're not quite sure who the performers are, and we're not quite sure who the audience are. But not to create anxiety, but rather to let people become completely immersed in that world, and that imaginative world. So they're part of it. They're not just looking in, they're not voyeurs. That's what I mean.
More?
Yep.
A couple of audience questions. I have a student question. How do you think youth culture, memes, vines, etc., serves as a form of surrealism, as a means of rationalizing our increasingly surreal world?
Again?
Again, yes. How do you think youth culture serves as a form of surrealism, as a means of rationalizing our increasingly surreal world?
I'm an eggplant, so I can't answer that.
I find, I'm amazed by the creativity of what's on the internet, and I always like feel a little weird. Maybe I'm feeling a little bit aspect of the surreal when I read articles that sort of like bitch and moan about like the millennial generation or even whatever the next one is after that. I think I don't even know what they're. I'm sure there's a new term, and I don't get it because I really think that at least the young people that I meet and interact with are like the most creative people I've ever met, and I'm always blown away by like how people are using not only creating amazing things but like using new media in like new tools to reinvent creativity itself. I mean, it's really. Really fascinating. I mean, I'm constantly inspired by what I see online. And I mean, obviously, you could with any set of tools, you can do good things and you can do bad things. So, I mean, that's always been true, right? I think that there's like memes are a new art form in a way. I mean, like there is incredible stuff out there on YouTube, right? I mean, like really mind-blowingly good. And then there are also super creepy, surreal videos for children. Right, I think that there's a lot of good going on out there. So for any older people in the room who maybe haven't engaged with that too much, give it a shot. Like, go exploring on the internet. You'll probably find some really cool stuff.
I'd recommend Baby TV if you haven't seen that yet. Baby TV, very interesting content.
I don't think surreality is just in the province of teenagers. My mother is 93, and she uses a garden gnome to help her get out of a chair.
Another student question. What do you think about the relation between reality and surreality in the psychedelic experience?
It's obviously an escape from the psychedelic experience. It's an escape from reality. I'm not sure it's surreality in the strictest sense. It's not. I'm going to go back to my definition. I don't necessarily think you experience juxtaposed realities when you're spaced out or on something. I think you experience an alternative reality. But that's not really surreality, because for me, I don't know. Hey, I'm not experienced. I'm not that experienced on getting high. So I can't. Nor is it. We haven't. So it's interesting that because when Masson started it, it was actually a reaction against the idea of normality as represented by French bourgeois society, very kind of middle class, very strict, very. And he was against breaking that. It seems to me, you know, we're in a very sort of liberal world here, particularly in Boulder. I am as well in London, you know. There aren't those constraints. So I think surreality manifests itself in different ways in liberal societies than it did when surreality was first invented. I'm not sure if that's answered the question, but I'll try.
I think that it, like, psychedelics help access surreality in a similar way that like overseas travel can. You know, like if you're tripping, like the world that is normal looks different, right? And you'll pay more attention to things like the patterns on fabric and, how water swirls in a stream, right? When else do you sometimes get those kinds of experiences that feel sort of childlike and really connected to the moment, even though you're no longer a child? I mean, often when you travel to a new place and you feel really uncomfortable and nothing works in the same way that you're used to. Mm-hmm. And that's particularly true if you haven't done a lot of travel. Like if you travel a lot, suddenly you get so practiced at it that it can, you're perhaps more jaded. But if you haven't traveled that much, or if you go to a place that feels extremely foreign, suddenly, like, you're also going to be paying a lot of attention to the weird textures on the fabrics because you've never seen them before, right? Like, maybe you've never drank from a Himalayan stream. That's going to be a real invitation to notice all of the beauty that is in the world around us and all of the strangeness as well.
I think another, like, just to kind of carry forward that same statement, is that this is about, whether it's psychedelics or travel or what have you, it's about accessing something new, expanding our perception, expanding our experiences, and doing things that are challenging and different for us so that we can continue to break down our ideas of what we think are real or unreal. We're in this funny space in this conversation because the panel's asking us to have a dialogue between the real and the surreal, but most of all, we actually want to talk about what's not reality, I think, is like kind of where I see the conversation going, and that's sort of an interesting just observation. But to put ourselves into spaces that are where we can learn and grow and expand by doing things that are challenging or different for us, like overseas travel, or like training to be a circus performer, or like going to a performance you've never been to that maybe was you were intimidated by. These are ways that we can, I think, further our understanding of reality or other people's perception of reality.
I think one thing I'm kind of hearing, and it touches what you mentioned in the very beginning, is that the surreal moments are always only temporary, and it's kind of what I'm hearing on the panel right now. When you are traveling to a new country for the very first time, everything feels a little bit unreal or even surreal. If you're imagining, oh, what if I were a spy? It sounds very, very unreal at the beginning, but then you start to dig deeper and you start to understand what would actually a life like a spy look like. And it all of a sudden becomes like when you start to get out of this temporary field, it all of a sudden starts to become quite real after a while. Mm. Like if you're staying in that country for long enough, it becomes reality to you, right? It doesn't feel strange or unreal to you anymore. Same when you go to a festival, like maybe your first experience there feels super unreal and out of this world, but then imagine this festival would last for 3 months, and then I think at the end of this it would be like, wow, this is really reality now, and I maybe have a different perspective on that as well. But it's just interesting to see that the surreal kind of seems to only last for when we first encounter it.
Hmm. Great observation.
So we need to maybe search for new, if we want to continue, we need to kind of search for new and more and more and other surreal.
Maybe that's moments. Why people take drugs.
Yeah.
Or take more. I mean, there is. I'm sort of contradicting myself now, because I'm thinking if Andre Masson was here, he'd be down at the smoke shops. He would probably do that.
Just to experience it.
Just to experience something that was different from the norm, and to challenge that.
I think that, like, probably the most psychedelic experience any of us has ever had was being born, right? Like, I mean, like, that would be just... we can't even remember it because it was too overwhelming, right? I mean, it's like, yeah, hopefully it wasn't too bad of a trip. But I do think that speaks to what you were saying, how like we are machines, we are learning machines for figuring out all that stuff. I mean, babies are the best example, right? Like, can you imagine all the things they have to just fit? Like, what is color? Like, what is perspective? Like, how did any of this work? And like now, even when you're an adult, you're learning to do handstands, right? So I think that there is something really interesting that like humans are incredibly good at acclimatizing to the wherever we are, right? Whatever we're experiencing. Mm-hmm. Like we are, like we can normalize anything so fast that like having new pathways and new opportunities to access that feeling of novelty is really powerful.
I wondered if babies dreamed.
Yeah.
I guess they do. I think there's evidence that they do. I don't know enough about it. It's just interesting whether babies dream, whether they have an unconscious self as well as a discovering reality.
Yeah.
On that same dreaming topic, we have a question here that's asking, do any of you lucid dream? If yes, can you share some thoughts about them?
Do we
lucid? Lucid dreaming?
Do you remember your dream?
Oh, okay.
I have lucid dreams. So that's like a practice that you can actually train, right? So there are a number of... Has anybody like also... Okay, cool. So quite a few. So for anybody who hasn't, lucid dreaming is not just when you remember your dreams, but it's when you realize you're dreaming in the dream and thereby hijack it. So that's lucid dreaming. And there are some really sort of like fun, like... life hacks, basically, that allow you to practice. This is actually something everybody can achieve. It is not, like, it's easy to train, right? And if you Google it, it'll be easy to figure out how. But, like, there are some funny things with it. Like, for example, one way to start is you start journaling the dreams you have right when you wake up, because very often we forget immediately, right? So you keep a little journal right next to your bed, and then the second you wake up, you write down everything you can remember. And then you also do other odd things, like, for example, mechanical objects often do not work as they are supposed to in dreams. So if you are in a dream, if you suspect you may be in a dream, turn off and on the lights, right? Literally go like this, and you will, and if it doesn't work like it should, you're probably in a dream. Physics also doesn't work very well in dreams. So if you have a ball, throw it against the wall and see what happens. And if it starts doing weird things, you're probably in a dream. Text also doesn't work very well. So if you have a book in your dream, start actually reading it. And if you're like, why can't I quite focus on the word, right? Like suddenly that's a clue. So the real trick is you need to make sure that when you're in your dream, you have that little rubber ball in your pocket, right? Or you have that like poem that you can use as a test. So the way that you train yourself to lucid dream is you bring that around in waking life all the time. Because then you learn that you always have a ball in your pocket. You learn that you always have this text that can be your reality test, right? And then when you use it when you appear in your dream, you're like, oh, I just need my ball, and it's there. Right? So now you can do your test. So there are a bunch more of these that you can use and practice with. But the fun thing is that like once you're in the dream and you're in control, you can change things. Right? So I remember once, this was when I was a kid, and I had a dream where I was like being chased by a murderer through a safari or like a savanna. And so there was very high grass. And it was terrifying, right? It's like one of those dreams where you don't really know what's chasing you, right? But like it is, and it's gonna just rip you apart. And so I was fleeing through this rough grass, and then I was like, this just, no, come on, right? And so when I realized, like, wait a minute, something, I can, like, this is not quite right, I was like, okay. So I turned around, and I reached behind my back, and I pulled out a crossbow. Right, which definitely had not been there before. And I started hunting the thing that was chasing me. And it was really, that was much better. you can easily make yourself fly or float. Like, those are also fun things. So anyway, look up lucid dreaming. It'll definitely be a surreal experience.
Thank you, Elliot. I think I'm picking up a new hobby.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yes, I did catch it and shot it with the crossbow. Yeah. I survived. Yeah.
Do I use lucid dreaming for design?
Oh, there you go.
Are you hijacking the system here?
Someone asks, would it be okay if I threw a rubber chicken at you?
Really weird.
And what's the difference between the surreal and the just plain silly?
I think it comes back to that definition. It's not. It is. I mean, the painters look to juxtaposed realities, not just something silly and mad, but actually, you know, you look at a painting by Dali or Ernst, and you see these, or the Greek is a classic example, and you see these real things strangely placed together so that they disturb. It's actually quite a skillful thing. So I think it's not just silly, it's disturbing, strange, and unsettling, and we don't know why it unsettles, because it taps into our unconscious desires, fears, dreams, whatever. So I think they're quite separate, actually.
I think silliness is sort of an access point to kind of breaking away some of the things about the way that we do stuff or the way that we present ourselves or the way we normally talk. It's more of like a way to kind of crack the door open in a way to the line between the real and the surreal, which is why I suggested that you say my snack name, at the beginning of the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I think like Donald Duck is silly, Donald Duck roasting on a spit is surreal.
Right? Yeah, and still talking.
Right.
Yeah.
That's dark.
Well, yeah, I mean, Big Bird as president is quite silly.
Yeah.
Not thought of.
See that in my mind. So, a student question. How do you address your personal conflicts between realistic and surrealistic thinking to avoid feeling lost or isolated?
Can you repeat that?
Absolutely. So, how do you address your personal conflicts between realistic and surrealistic thinking to avoid feeling lost or isolated?
I would suggest just talking to the people around you, sharing your thoughts and your experience. If you feel isolated, connect with the people in your life so that tell them you need them. Tell them that you need them to share in your weird ideas so that you're not alone in them. That's my first thought.
I think there's an element of surrealism that's about escapism. We all need escapism. And escapism can help us deal with reality because we can invent a different reality. It's very valuable in that way, just like dreams are very valuable. They release something, don't they?
There's a question in a similar vein. Do you see any difference between interpersonal and intrapersonal surrealism? Can it be a communicative barrier, or is it only useful for communication?
Can I have another chicken?
I don't know what to ask.
We need a philosopher.
Can you read it one more time?
Do you see any difference between interpersonal and intrapersonal surrealism?
So I think when I think about that, it really gets to just like the nature of reality, right? I mean, like, none of us can truly prove that the universe exists outside our own experience of it, right? So I think that fascination with how reality is sort of recursive, our experience of reality is recursive, is why I mentioned that strange loops concept in the opening remarks, because I think that's part of the appeal, right? Like in some ways, each one of us is an Escher painting, right? Like that's our experience of life. So I think that embedding that feeling is part of what creates the emotional resonance in the audience of it feeling strange and disturbing, right? Like that's putting that into some piece of art or creating some experience that embeds that concept. That's like the emotion you're creating at the end of the day, just like a comedian is trying to create laughter with a punchline.
I think surreality scrutinizes reality, doesn't it? Mm. So, you know, is this real? It might not be. It might not be. What's that thing? I can't think. You know, the Chinese philosopher who dreamt he was a butterfly was never quite sure if he wasn't a butterfly, dreaming he was a Chinese philosopher. Disgust.
More questions here. This one's for Lena. How do you learn to fail better?
Beckett.
Fail more often.
Fail again.
I think it's really just that. The first failure, I think, is the hardest to take. And once you start to get used to failure, it's much easier to just like get up on your feet again and just do it all over again. And it doesn't hurt that much to fail again because you know what you've learned from your first failure. So you know when you fall again that you will stand up and you will be a little bit stronger because of what you take from that failure. So if you get a master of failure, you start to understand how much you're taking away from it. So you start to embrace it a little bit differently. But yeah, I think it's just like do it over and over again.
I was struck by the fact that you're sort of the opposite of an actor, because an actor in a play rehearses, and when they're rehearsing, it's kind of surreal because they're pretending to be someone else in the space. And then when they go on stage, they have to be like absolutely real. You're the opposite. Your rehearsing phase is the reality, the pain. And then when you're up there, you're in this different world.
It's a flip.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, yes, we're in a different world, but we're still dealing with forgetting the real to be a surreal in that moment. Like the actor probably is trying to forget himself in order to be a different person.
Yeah, sure.
One more question. How do you balance the discomfort and joy of surreal experiences in your work?
How do we balance the discomfort and
Is that the answer?
I mean, I guess like one thing that Lena was talking about that really resonated with me is just how creative work is not that fun, right? I mean, like there's a joke among novelists that poets can write when they're inspired, right? But if you're a novelist, you actually are distinguished by the fact that you have to write when you're uninspired. I like running, and it feels really similar to me to running, because running is terrible, right? Like 80% of the time, running is awful. And then 20% of the time, it's amazing, and you're feeling it, and like you just feel excited and energized, and that's what writing feels like to me. And just as in running, even if it sucks, having run feels really, really good. Same with writing. Like if I have a day where I don't do some kind of creative work, I start to feel really similarly to a day where I don't get any exercise. It just sort of feels like things are building up inside of me. I get more sort of like easily frustrated and all those kinds of things. And so there's this funny balance of discomfort and joy in the creative process of trying to create something that is surreal and mixes the surreal and the real for others to enjoy, right? So that's sort of a funny thing. And I've also found that often the more I struggle with something, the more the harder it is to get through, the more times I just want to give up the project, usually the results are better, right? Because if I have that much internal conflict about something that I have to work through, that actually embeds like that internal conflict into the experience I'm creating for someone else, right? So I think that often my best work is when I have the most sequential existential crises as I'm creating it. One other thing that I just find really fascinating, because it's certainly true for me, and I've talked to many other writers who also find this to be the case, and so this is really just sort of weird, is that when I'll write a whole rough draft, and then I'll start editing it. I don't edit as I go, because that would paralyze me. So I write the whole rough draft, and then I go into editorial. And when I go into editorial, you know, I often haven't actually like read through the first few chapters in many months, right? Because I've been writing them the whole time. And when I go back through and start editing that rough draft, there is no difference in quality between the scenes I wrote when I was feeling the most inspired and the scenes I wrote when I wanted to throw everything away. Like, literally, I cannot even identify how I might have been feeling at the time when I go back later. There is zero correlation in my own work between my feeling of inspiration and the quality of the output, which is, I find, surreal. Yeah, that's sort of how I try to balance that discomfort and joy.
I want to reinforce what Elliot said in the first part of your statement, which is that a lot of the time I'm creating things that are meant to be an experience for other people, a joyful experience for other people, and that work, such as your training, is incredibly uncomfortable, and most of the time, I don't really get to experience that joy with the participants because I'm actually putting in this grueling work. But the balance of it is when someone comes to me and says that they have had a life-changing experience, and that is kind of feeding back into this thing that I'm attempting to create for people. And I think that carries across different disciplines and industries.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a scenographer. I create visual aspects of performance. And for me, it's a balance between real and surreal. I might be creating something that is very strange, very surreal, very disturbing. I actually, unlike my colleague, his designer, I don't need to dream. Although I do know some sonographers who do need to dream before they can say what it is. I actually like total normality and normality around me and embrace reality and logic while I'm working on something. I like that balance of being logical and ordered and creating something that is strange, unsettling, and unreal. And so I think, you know, the balance of the reality and surreality in creative processes, for me, very important.
I really think you have to go through a lot of discomfort in order to enjoy the joy of the surrealism. Like, I'm just thinking of an improv presentation, for example, where you have no idea, you go through a lot of discomfort because you have no idea what you're going to perform, and there's going to be an audience, and it feels so uncomfortable. And it can go terribly wrong as well. It can be really, really bad. But then sometimes even you go through this discomfort, and then sometimes all of a sudden there is this magical moment where something surreal happens. It's just that in the moment and with the people that are in the room, you're creating something that all of a sudden sparks and that is interesting and surreal, and we all have the same like really weird experience with that. But it only is happening because we went through the discomfort and we didn't know which way it would go. It was completely unclear at the beginning, and I think it's really this discomfort that then gives you the joy, and that makes the joy even better because it could also have gone really the wrong way and it totally gone south. So I think they both have to exist in order to exist.
It's very interesting what you said about improvisation, releasing surreality, because I've just done a project working with older people in London between 70 and 90, and they've never performed before, and they did some improvisation with some students of mine who were improvising design elements, costume, sound, light, while they were improvising these strange things. I mean, it was chaotic at times. But I mean, some things that happen, you're right, some amazing moments happened. There was a moment where one of my students put a bike tire in front of a performer saying, it's a mirror. She didn't say it's a mirror, but please see it's a mirror. And the performer, who was in the late 80s, started to do the mirror. Then she walked through the tyre. She wanted to go through it. And as she walked through it, she became this young woman, and we suddenly had to sort of devise these things. So this work, this strange kind of surreal, unreal world came out of this moment. It kind of, yeah, it released something in her that she wanted to have. And the improvisation can do that because it's not controlled. Lots of the time it's terrible, believe me. I mean, that's what happens when you do a project like that.
Have any other questions for each other before we wrap up? No? Well, thank you so much.
Chicken.
This has been great.